Coming up on this week's show, the Amiga Mini is finally on its way.
A true classic hits the Super Nintendo and Mega Drive.
And we chat to Chris Barnett of Explaining Computers.
The Retro Hour podcast is made possible each week with our wonderful friends at Bitmap Books. Now, you need to check out Commodore Amiga, a visual compendium. Over 420 pages celebrating 140 of the biggest games on the platform and bringing them to life and interviewing some of the biggest developers, publishers, including RJ Michael, David Braben, Sid Meier, and lots more. You can check out that and all their other retro titles at bitmapbooks.co.uk. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 288. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the show that takes you behind the scenes on the world of retro computing and gaming with exclusive interviews on the show this week. And we bring you up to speed with everything that's been happening in the world of retro with our resident rabble of retro ragamuffins, the Retro Hour crew. Lots of new stories to get through this week as well, including something I'm sure Joe is really hyped to talk about. The Amiga Mini is finally here.
I am very hyped to talk about it, actually. I'll have you know, Daniel. Nah, it looks awesome. It looks awesome.
It's well known that, you know, Joe's our console guy. Ravi and I love Amigas. But actually, the announcement of this mini Amiga has been making headlines, you know, on the Metro, all these mainstream news sites. And actually, we've got a bit of an opinion on, you know, kind of against the grain of what I've seen online recently as to who this is aimed at. So we're going to talk more about that in just a bit. And I think, Joe, you might be the target audience for this Amiga Mini.
You're giving it away. You're giving my opinion away.
It's not just us harping on about Amigas this time. No. It's everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. And there's been a remake of an Amiga classic game that we need to talk about in just a bit as well. And we are going to be joined by a special guest, as always. Now, this is actually someone who we've had quite a lot of requests for, because, Sam, you may know that we've been running a survey on our website for the last, like, 6 weeks or so. And a lot of people have been suggesting guests that they want to hear on the show. And I guess this week, Chris Barnett, a load of people mentioned him. We'd love to hear kind of what his history is with computers, because he does a really popular YouTube channel called Explaining Computers, which, as you'd imagine, I mean, a lot of it is modern technology, isn't it? But he does do quite a bit of retro stuff in there as well.
Yeah, his show is like, it's probably the closest thing to like the BBC in like a presentation style. And it's like he says in the interview, you know, he aims to be on like BBC One and have that kind of old style computer show, but the presentation's really high quality. And Chris himself is a computer science teacher as well, and a futurologist, so he kind of knows about the future. But we're actually talking about the retro stuff, but also the future of retro, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's a really interesting interview. And you know, this week's show is a bit more computer focus, because that's kind of Chris's area. I mean, we talk about games as well in here. But really, I mean, if you're a fan of, in particular, 8-bit machines from the UK, you know, a lot of Spectrum talk in here, Commodore 64, Amiga talk. And yeah, you're right. Because he's a futurologist, we put a question to him in the interview that, you know, what do you think retro is going to look like in 20 to 30 years from now? And he gave us some really interesting answers, stuff that we hadn't really thought about before.
Yeah, we kind of came up with some really interesting themes and ideas, and also looked at the past. Like, we were talking about Netscape Navigator and how actually browsers, you charged money for browsers. You couldn't do that nowadays. And operating systems as well. Even operating systems are free now. So how things have kind of changed and how the future's going to look with retro technology.
You know, it's mad because obviously Windows XP turns 20 years old in like, what, 2 or 3 months? And I remember like queuing up for that and paying something like, I feel like it was nearly £100, you know, for an upgrade kit from Windows 98.
Joe, just imagine if they said like, oh, you need to install Chrome. Can you pay £20, please?
Dan, can you give me a cracked copy?
Ravi's your man for that.
Ravi's my man, yeah.
But yeah, this is going to be a really interesting chat. Chris Barnett from the YouTube channel Explaining Computers coming up on the show in around 20 minutes from now. Now, we do talk about obscure media and stuff in there as well, and stuff from back in the day, jazz drives, zip drives. And you've been getting into cassette tape collecting again recently, Ravi.
Yeah, I'm not getting into like my smash hits and those kind of old tapes.
You're benign. Bananarama tapes.
But yeah, my Bananarama collection. I've been getting old tapes because I'm currently volunteering in a charity shop, actually. It's quite good fun. I really miss retail, and I can pretend that I've got like loads of video games and go through the selection. But I've got a little tape cassette deck, and I've found some blank tapes as well. And I'm actually going to experience, you know, we're so used to fast loading these days. I'm going to experience what it was like, because I didn't really have those 8-bit machines, to have a game on tape and load it up again and kind of sit there waiting for it and hearing the noises and the whirl of the tape. Is that a bit sad? I don't know.
I predict you'll do it once and then go back to your SD card reader.
And plug my iPhone in.
Everyone should experience that way at least once, I think. So, yeah, really good show coming up this week. Now, lots of stuff to get through. Before we do, let's give a mention to one of our amazing sponsors this week. And this is our friends at Old School Gamer Magazine. Now, we're all big fans of magazines. I mean, you even work on a magazine, Revy.
Oh, yeah. And trust me, it is tough. And it's amazing to see what they've done with Old School Gamer Magazine here.
Now, this is dedicated to the gamer who enjoys everything from arcade game collecting, refurbishing systems as well, which, you know, if you are a retro collector, refurbs are a big part of the hobby these days. You know, playing to the home console gamer, reliving your childhood from the 70s, 80s and 90s. And also what I think is really interesting about Old School Gamer Magazine is they do quite focus heavily on the next generation of gamers as well and passing it on to them, which is really cool. Now, the team behind it are lifelong gamers, really passionate about classic games, and they do some really in-depth articles about classic games and hardware. Like, if you check out their website, you can actually sign up for free to their digital version and have a look through it. So this is a free retro gaming magazine, 24 to 30 pages, comes out every other month that you can read. And recently, I've been loving some of their kind of deep dives into stuff like light gun games. I imagine Josie has just lit up when I said that.
I haven't actually read the light gun one yet, but I was actually reading the Resident Evil trilogy one, the original trilogy on the PlayStation. And I've also got a really interesting one, which is a look back at the 25 years of E3, which is really cool to kind of see it, like, you know, grow and change over the years. It's a really, really awesome little magazine.
I think it's really cool that it's available digitally as well. You know, I work on a magazine and there's a lot of people that read it on an iPad or a tablet or different devices or even on the phone kind of zoomed in. So really cool that you get a free digital edition here.
Yeah, so you can support our podcast and, of course, check out this free Old School Gamer magazine by using our link, which is oldschoolgamer.com/retro. Give these guys some of your support. They're absolutely incredible. And they've been kind enough to come on board with the Retro Hour as well. So we want everyone to go and check this out right now. Head to this link in your browser, oldschoolgamer.com/retro. And a big thank you to our friends at Old School Gamer Magazine for their support of the Retro Hour. Now let's get into this story that's been absolutely everywhere, because we've been looking every week. You know, we do our little thing, you know, we chat on Facebook Messenger, like, you guys spotted any retro news this week? You know, Joe and I save them in our Facebook saved section and we put them in a Google Doc and everything. Today we've been looking around and literally everything was just Amiga Mini.
Well, can I just do something that I've waited for 28 years to do?
You built this up now. This better be good.
Amiga is back, baby.
All right, that was worth the wait.
It never went. It never went, Ravi. You guys have been keeping it alive.
But this is now, obviously it's the guys who brought us the 64. Which was the Commodore 64 Mini that came out a few years ago. Now, then they made the Maxi version, which was a full-size, essentially a Commodore 64 replica, FPGA-based, full keyboard on there as well. This one is one of the mini ones, though. Now, you actually get some really cool stuff with this.
And also, you know, it's kind of taken 28 years to get to this point because nothing commercially has kind of been released from the Amiga because there's been legal battles and stuff. So this is the closest thing to anything official you're going to get. But you know what? This is a mini console, and I don't really think it's aimed at me and Dan, who already have Amigas coming out of our ears. It's aimed at someone like Joe, who is a brand new user, and you were actually looking at getting a CD32, weren't you? So what do you think of this machine, and what appeals about it and what doesn't?
Okay, well, I'll start with what doesn't appeal about it is that they're trying to keep the pricing with Amiga going, you know, with it being nice and expensive compared to other consoles. I think it's quite a lot for a mini console that's coming out at £120.
Which, if you try and get an Amiga 500, though,
yeah,
some of them go for about 300 quid boxed, you know, good condition.
I do get that, but if you want to use that same argument with like the Sega Mega Drive Mini, which was like 60 quid at release, and at the time you could get a Mega Drive for like 30 quid. But I get it; you get all the games with it. And what I do like about it, which is one of the reasons I've always been kind of put off old school computers and stuff, is it's going to be a plug and play. You're not going to have to piss about. You know, as Ravi just said, you know, changing all the hardware on it, pissing about with cards and stuff like that. It is just going to be, I'm assuming, plug it in and you go ahead and you play it, you plug it into your TV. I really like that you get the controller, the mouse and the keyboard. I'm not familiar with Amiga controllers, so I don't know if that's...
In this version, the keyboard, like, because when they released the C64 Mini, they had the keyboard wasn't working, so you had to plug an external one in. Mm-hmm. And then they released one called the Maxi, which had a working keyboard. And I guess that's because of the price range, like, you know, to get all those keys going and everything.
Yeah, and the size.
I get it.
I was just saying, I think it's expensive, but I do understand. I will probably buy one. Like, I do really like the look of it, and I like the sound of the games on there as well. It's going to have 25 games on it, and they revealed 12 so far. But what I really, really, really like about it is this is one of the first kind of big release mini consoles I've seen where they are actually advertising that you can put your own USB stick and run your own Amiga ROMs on it.
Yeah.
And also firmware updates. So for hackability.
You don't see that. I mean, you can do it with like the PlayStation Mini and stuff, but that's not something that they were like openly saying they can do. Whereas this seems to be pretty open. Like, yeah, you know, stick USB stick in and play some other Amiga ROMs on there. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to playing a bit of Zool, Worms, Chaos Engine, and then also Simon the Sorcerer, one you guys always go on about. But yeah, I think it looks cool, and I will agree. I don't think it's aimed at, like, Dan, I don't think it's aimed at Ravi. I think it is aimed at people like me who never quite got into it, or some people like your brother, Dan, who are nostalgic for it. He might pick one up and be like, yeah, you know what, I've not had an Amiga in 28 years. I'll buy one of these and play it. You know, I think it will do all right.
And I think it will increase the user base of people interested in Amiga. Like, you know, if you, like, someone's mum's going around and goes, oh, you used to have that, and then buys it, then other people may go, oh, I'll actually get one of the original machines, or I'll get one of these new faster ones or something. So I think it opens it up a bit.
Well, let's talk a bit about what comes with it then. So you've got the Amiga, well, it's called the A500 Mini. There's no Amiga branding on here. Mm-hmm. Because as we know, you know, the world of Amiga copyrights and licenses, they're very, very complicated. Mm. There's pretty much been litigation and court cases going on for like, what, 25 years
now? Since Commodore went, pretty much.
So this is the A500, it's called, but it looks pretty much identical to, if you can imagine an Amiga 500, smaller than your mobile phone, actually, really small little device. It comes with a replica of the original Amiga 500 mouse that is affectionately known as the Tank Mouse, by the looks of it, a USB version. And there's actually a photo of the A500 Mini next to the mouse, and it looks really cute. You know, it's really small.
And that's essential as well. You know, they could have packed it with a D-pad that would mean that you'd control up and down and like the mouse play, but that really wouldn't work with games like Simon the Sorcerer.
Lemmings. Imagine trying to play that with a D-pad. But then you get a controller with it as well, which this has been a bit controversial. Some people are like, because most of us played Amiga games with a joystick originally. That said, I do know a lot of people that use Mega Drive pads on them back then. And this is actually a pad that you get with it, not a joystick. It looks like kind of an evolution of the CD32 controller.
And the original CD32 controllers were absolutely awful. Like, the D-pads were really bad on them.
This looks nicer.
And this looks a lot nicer and a lot more playable. So actually, even the controller alone would be something that I'd be interested in.
Well, it looks like a cross between a CD32 controller and a SNES controller, really. Now, the colour scheme on it. Nice D-pad on there. You got the two buttons in the middle, like the CD32. Then you've got the different colour buttons. It's quite like a SNES. Shoulder buttons on the top as well. What I haven't read is, because I know there are some kind of third-party controllers available for the Amiga where you can actually map, like, say, the Y button to be the up button. Because a lot of Amiga games, platformers in particular, it was up to jump, which if you can remap this, so, like, you could use one of the buttons to jump, that would make, you know, I think a lot of the complaints that I've seen today would be answered. People are like, you know, trying to jump up on a platform with a control pad can be very fiddly. But yeah, I mean, apart from that, it is what you expect, I think. Like you said, Joe, you can put a USB stick in there. It's got WHD load support, which lets you install Amiga games to a hard disk. You can just download loads of them, put the stick in, and really enhance your library. And even though this looks like an Amiga 500, apparently it is going to be able to play later Amiga games like the AGA chipset of the Amiga 1200 as well. So A1200-only game should work on here too. So really, this is going to give you access to pretty much every Amiga game, you know, all the mainstream ones, and should run great on
here. It's got three ports at the back, so I guess like one's going to be for the mouse, and then you could have two joystick or gamepad ports, which means you can do that two-player co-op experience, which is like essential with games like Chaos Engine and stuff, you know, when you're sitting together with your mate, or Speedball, yeah. And then you could use any USB controller in there, I reckon.
Yeah, and you've got HDMI output and just a power connector, and that is it. So, yeah, really it is. I mean, it's an Amiga emulator that's in a cute little case. It's plug and play. And really, this is going to make life, you know, as simple as using a Mega Drive or a Super Nintendo Mini. So really it is a small console-ized plug and play Amiga, which I think, you know, if you haven't got a background with the platform, which is a complaint I've seen today, people are like, well, can it boot Workbench? Can I, you know, you can plug a keyboard in. So, I mean, it probably could, but it's not aimed at that market. You know, this is aimed at people are going to see it in game or HMV, and yeah, people that maybe owned one 30 years ago, or people like Joe that have probably heard a lot about the Amiga, you know, probably through us rattling on about it, and actually maybe want to experience that world. And you know, admittedly, it is quite pricey for these kind of systems, but at £120, I think it is still affordable for people that want to get hold of it and experience it.
Also for young people, like, you know, I've seen a lot of people saying this is ideal for me to give to the kids and have the kids, like, they don't want them on their original hardware. Have the kids have this machine and they could spill Coca-Cola all over it and they can get mental, you know. And
my nephew would be like, can it play Fortnite? Oh, it's rubbish. So have we got a release date on this then?
It just says 2022.
Yeah.
But that's all it says.
Which isn't far away now, 2022, actually.
Yeah, it's hard. It's kind of like, is it going to be in 4 or 5 months' time, or is it in a year's time? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But yeah, it just says 2022 at the moment, but we've got, like I say, 12 games. So Alien Breed 3D, Another World, All Terrain Racing, Battle Chess, is that Cadaver? Kickoff 2, Pinball Dreams, and then Simon the Sorcerer, Speedball 2, Chaos Engine, Worms Director's Cut, and Zool on there.
They're big games.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure they're... I mean, I'm like you say, I'm not a big Amiga boy, but
it's a lot of the
sure
Team 17.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm sure games. They're pretty big games.
And you know what? I'm just happy that something's come out, because If something hadn't have come out, it probably would have just been lost in the legacy of time. And, you know, it's nice to see the Amiga up there with the other mini consoles, and it brings a new audience to it as well.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming, something like this, I think, you know, just even though you said before, you know, it's not aimed at me and Ravi. Don't know about you, Ravi. I'm going to buy one of these. I just want one in the living room just to play Amiga games in there.
I'm going to buy a Mega 65 as well. Just to have the bases. Two systems, yeah. But this will be the drunk one. This will be the one that I spill all my beer all over.
So hopefully we're going to get some of the guys from the team on for a chat before launch, and we'll keep you up to date on that as we hear more. Now, of course, we do love our consoles. And this is a game, actually. I know this is quite a famous game on the PC back in the day. I played this mostly on the Atari Lynx, quite randomly. This is a Chips Challenge that now is finally landing. This article here on Nintendo Life says makes its console debut. But it was on the Atari Lynx, the SNES and the Mega Drive.
I was going to say, it actually, according to the... It's funny, because according to the same article, it was actually on the Atari Lynx first, anyway.
Right, it was an original Atari Lynx game.
It was originally an original Atari Lynx game.
Yeah, it was actually Chuck Somerville, who we've had on the podcast before, and he was the designer and programmer of Chips Challenge, and it's kind of a fun little tile game, and you're right, it was originally on the Atari Lynx. It's quite a simple, like, basic game, but it's never really had this.
I was about to say that. I get stuck on it.
Yeah, it's a puzzle game. But, I mean, graphically. Yeah. It was quite simple, but it's never... It's got a cult following. And, you know, there was Chip Challenge 2 as well. And it's never really gone onto the kind of mainstream consoles. But now there's been a port. And these ports are like official ones. You can actually buy them. And I find this really interesting about the ports. They've done two versions for each console. So they've done a PAL version and an NTSC version for the SNES and the Mega Drive and Genesis, of course. So you can actually choose your region version and get a boxed with instruction booklet copy of the game and actually run that on it.
You actually stole my information because that was mostly all I knew about it as well. but yeah, I love that you can get like the Mega Drive or the Genesis version, and then the actual game cartridge is the NTS, the, you know, the American NTSC one or the PAL English one, which, you know, British one, which I really, really love, because so many companies, you know, like Zavvi, who we've got in the UK, keep putting all these SNES games out, and they're the NTSC ones, and it's like, you're a UK company and they don't work in the UK, like, why are you doing this? Whereas these guys, this is coming from the Retro Room Games, are putting this out. They've done their research, they know, you know, what shape the bloody cartridges need to be and stuff, which I really, really like. They're up for pre-order now. I'm on the page at the moment. We've not got any sort of like timescale of when we will get them, unfortunately. But it does look really, really cool, and I really like the artwork that they've got for the game as well.
I think you're right as well, though, Joe, the fact that, you know, they've actually tailored this for different markets. So I'm looking here, I mean, you know, you've got the two massively different designs of the cartridges on the Super Nintendo. Those North American ones, like, I didn't like the look of the North American Super Nintendo anyway. Really boxy design, isn't it? And the carts look like that as well. You know, they look a lot better in the PAL regions.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I've just said it, but I was sick of seeing these companies put them out for UK release and then being like, oh yeah, they work on the SNES as well. Like, I remember specifically somebody commenting on it and saying, well, it was actually a friend of mine commenting on Zavi's post about the Mega Man release, like, so you're saying this works on a UK Super Nintendo? And they commented back like, yeah, it'll work perfectly fine. It's like, won't even fit. It's not, do you know what I mean? It's got this big side on it. So I'm really glad the Retro Room have done this, catered to our needs.
It does seem to be a week of reboots and remasters. A game that's coming to Xbox One, Sam & Max Save the World. Now, this remaster was available for Switch and PC already, yeah?
Yeah, it's kind of passed me by, this one, and I think Sam & Max was such a huge title back then that, you know, it's worth talking about. Do you remember the Sam & Max games at all?
I do, but I've never played them. People are probably going to be screaming at me now, like, what do you mean you've never played Sam & Max? I've never played them. Maybe this is an excuse to play them, but do they start out as 2D games and then they moved into, like, the 3D realm?
No, it's like a point-and-click game, wasn't it?
It's like Day of the Tentacle that kind of period when they had like these animated kind of point-and-click adventures.
And
this was actually done by LucasArts Games, so it was like their kind of attempt to get into that genre. And it was one of the first games to include a full-speech soundtrack and music as well. And it was pure comedy. Like, it kind of had that Blues Brothers or kind of two detective kind of vibes, and it was really adult as well. They had to actually tone it back originally because it was quite an adult game. And you might remember some of the mini games that it had in there. So it had a whack-a-mole which had like live rats, and you had to kind of hit the live rats and stuff like that. And it had a really good kind of detective plot. They were both in a detective agency.
And, yeah.
I remember when that came out, it was like Full Throttle was another title that was a kind of full speech adventure. And this is when CD-ROM really kind of kicked off on the PC. Mm. So it's good to see it starting to hit the other consoles, and especially a redone version, because these are also legendary cult characters.
See, I haven't played this. Again, I've got a Switch, you know, and a PC, obviously. And I wasn't even aware of this. So this is something that kind of gone under my radar. I didn't play the originals back in the day. But again, Dave the Tentacle, I didn't really play that back in the day, but I bought the remastered version of that in the last few months and been really enjoying it. So if it's anything, you know, up to that kind of standard, they tend to do a really good job of bringing these old LucasArts adventure games.
It was kind of like Dave the Tentacle, but it had FMV cutscenes between it of them like doing adventures and certain stuff. Like, I'm looking at the demo at the moment, well, the trailer of it, and there's a certain scene that really brings back the nostalgia for me, which is when they're both in a presidential kind of Cadillac and they're jumping across the sky. That was one of the big FMV kind of things that popped up, and you know, it had all the interactive elements, and they seem to have got the characters really nicely done in this as well. And like you said, it's available for the Switch and and previous consoles as well. But it looks like a really good remaster. Hopefully some of our listeners can let us know what this is like and if they've enjoyed the Sam & Max remake.
Now, like I said, it does seem to be the week where every story pretty much is an old game from the past is back again. This one is another one that's been making the headlines everywhere. And kind of, you know, people that were interested in the Amiga Mini announcement might be interested in this one. Zool is coming back. Now, there might be some people listening that are like, what are you talking about? Ghostbusters. Nothing to do with Ghostbusters. This was kind of what was bigged up back in the day, even though it came out on different platforms. It was described by many of the magazines and in the advertising back in around 92, 93 as the Amiga's answer to Sonic the Hedgehog.
I would potentially agree with that. So my experience with Zool is only briefly playing the Master System version at a friend's house. And I remember thinking, like, this is like Sonic, but better. Like, I mean, I was naive. I was like 5 or 6 years old. But it'd be nice to get my hands on this again and play it again. And I'm a sucker for playing, like, old remastered games with achievements and stuff, like Xbox and PlayStation.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was very hype train back in the day. So it was like, Zool is better than Sonic. And they really pushed it hard. And
there was one of the Amiga magazines that actually had a cover of Zool punching Sonic the Hedgehog out.
Nice.
Beating him up. Poor Sonic.
Poor Sonic. What I want to know is, does this remaster, you know, sponsored by Chupa Chumps?
Yeah. Well, you did actually, if you bought the Amiga version back in the day, you did get a lollipop, a Chupa Chups lolly in the box.
Nice.
Which people buy them on eBay still with them in there. I wouldn't suggest eating one from 30 years ago if you buy one of these off eBay.
Well,
today.
Amazingly, I did an article on Zool and the history of sponsorship with sweets. Mm. And originally they'd put it on Games Master and they'd put like all the Games Master logos in the background of the level. And I think one of the marketers was like, oh, that's a good idea. No, Chupa Chups were looking for sponsors, so they actually put that in. And crazily, Chupa Chups' original logo was done by Salvador Dali as well, which is just a bit...
Oh, really?
Mad. I did know that. I actually saw that this week in loads of articles for some reason. I wonder if it's because of Zool, related to Zool.
Maybe. Now.
It could be. So I'm reading the article. We've not got much word on what consoles and stuff it's coming to, so... So far, all I can see is it's coming to Steam for sure, but it doesn't seem to be anything about Xbox or PlayStation, which is a little bit worrying because I was just saying about how much I love playing these games on those consoles.
Well, I mean, the original game, even though all the articles are calling it, you know, the 90s Amiga game, which is interesting because I've seen a lot of this on the Facebook groups. And, you know, you and I, Joe, have talked about this on the show quite a bit, how kind of retroactively people's opinions of games tend to change. Mm. Because I remember when Zool came out, even though, you know, as Ravi said then, it wasn't really a Sonic the Hedgehog beater. But, you know, being an Amiga user back then with some, before we got a Mega Drive, some serious Sonic the Hedgehog envy. Mm. It was like the closest thing, you know, it was like a mascot that we can have. And I remember all my mates loved it.
Yeah.
And the magazines, you know, Amiga Format gave it, I think, 95%. All the mags got behind it. But on the forums, I've seen a lot of people saying, oh, I never liked it, you know, hating on it recently. And it kind of reminds me of... You know, we've talked about Altered Beast, for example, that, you know, back in there, I remember everyone loved that game. Now, all of a sudden, 30 years on, it tends to be regarded as a bad game.
Yeah.
That kind of, that reputation over the 30 years has kind of changed. And we've talked about other examples of this. You know, I've often wondered if it's because of certain YouTubers who might do reviews and hate on it, then all of a sudden people are like, oh, yeah, actually, it wasn't that good back in the day. But
yeah,
it is interesting how opinions seem to have changed quite a bit in, you know, just the Facebook groups I'm on in particular.
And it was also not just for the Amiga. It came out on the Amiga, but also it was on the Archimedes, the ST, MS-DOS, Game Boy, Game Gear, Master System, Genesis.
The SNES version was the best, actually. The SNES version is probably the best version of Zool, if you want to play, you know, up until now. But I think there is definitely a lot of nostalgia for it. And this new version, so this is, it's coming to Steam on next week, August the 18th, developed by Sumo Digital Academy. And there's a group of students that have been involved in this as well. This is called Zool Redimensioned. Now, there is actually a trailer that you can look at, and they've actually put quite a bit of extra stuff in here as well. There's going to be, 28 platforming challenges. I've completely redesigned some of the boss fights in there, the new secrets, challenges, extras to find as well. Achievements are in there, Joe. You'll be pleased to know.
Always.
But what is actually good, if you look at this trailer, the original Zool had quite a narrow play field, but they've actually zoomed it out quite a bit so you can see more of what's going on screen, which I think makes the game probably easier to play, actually.
Yeah, I've just been watching the trailer. I've watched it a couple of times now, and I couldn't put my finger on what looked different about it. And I was like, oh, he looks really small. The sprite looks really small, but it isn't that he looks really small. Like you say, it's they've zoomed it out so you can see a lot more of what's going on, which I think does make it look a little bit nicer in some ways as well as making the playing field easier to see what you're doing.
Yeah, and also the levels are looking like the old traditional levels as well. Like, it hasn't got the Chupa Chups in there, but it's still got the Sweetie kind of world, and then it's got the, like, Meccano world and the one with cassettes and all of that. So it's definitely nostalgic on that kind of level.
And the music's in there as well. That was a big part of the original game. On the Amiga, they had to pick between music or sound effects. This has got them both. So, you know, sound effects over the music.
Progress.
One thing I keep seeing, though, that is annoying me all over again, like it did in 1992, Zool is not an ant.
He's a gremlin.
Everywhere. The ninja ant is back. He's not, isn't it? I think he's a ninja from the nth dimension.
I thought it was a gremlin. I always thought it was a ninja gremlin. I don't know.
Well, Gremlin Graphics did make the original game, so that would make sense, I guess.
Maybe that's where the confusion has come from. But funny enough, I've not seen anything about him being an ant.
Didn't he have a female counterpart called Zooks as well at one point?
Zoos, I think her name was in the sequel, yeah.
Dan's first love.
But yeah, I mean, Zool 2 was probably my favourite of the games, so I'm hoping, you know, if this one is a success, they might actually remaster the second game as well. It's really good on the Atari Jaguar. A lot of Jag fans regard that as like one of the best platformers on the system. But again, it's kind of like a lot of people saying, what's going to be next? A Cool Spot remaster? Which I'd be up for that.
I was going to say, bring it on.
Yeah. The more the merrier. You know, it's always awesome to have these franchises from the past.
Rise of the Robots. Come on.
You know what? I think there was an attempt, and there is some YouTube footage of this. If you look, there was going to be a Zool reboot in around, I think it was like 2000, 2001. And there are like some intro animations. And I've got a feeling they're going to try and make it like, you know, like everything was in like kind of a 3D platformer. But it kind of looked a bit like it was going to be like Bubsy 3D or something. Okay. So I think they might change it to something else in the end. But yeah, so there's been attempts to kind of remaster it in the past. But yeah, it's never actually happened until now.
We need a Zool FPS. That would be good.
Yeah, so I'm glad he's back anyway. So hopefully the second game will get a remaster as well. And if you want to check it out, it'll be released on Steam next week. So we'll put a link to that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, we're recording the show pretty late at night. Another late one, nearly 10 p.m. I think it's about time maybe to crack a beer. What do you think, boys?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Celebrate another good episode of the Retro Hour. Oh,
yeah. We're only halfway through, yeah. I like your confidence. Well, this is our sponsor, our incredible friends at Beer 52, one of our favourite sponsors, who are back on board this week. Now, what about this? We all know the weather's been warm around the world recently. Maybe you've all been working a bit too hard. What about you just want to chill out and maybe have a nice beer? Well, as a listener to this podcast, you can get a case of craft beer from the USA on us. Now, this is our friends at Beer 52. Now, if you're based in the UK, have a look at this website, beer52.com/retro. That is beer52.com/retro. All you need to do is cover the £5.95 postage and they will deliver 8 delicious craft beers direct to your door. It is that simple. Now, Beer 52 are the world's most popular craft beer discovery club, and they're heading stateside once again, and you can join them for a beery adventure through the windy city of Chicago and sample the finest craft beer from the coolest Chicago breweries, from Bridgeport to Beverly, all for the price of postage. Now, we do love Beer 52. I mean, I've got one of their boxes here. Joe always dives in for the snack straight away.
I always do that straight away. stuff my face with the snack and then crack open a cold beer.
They've actually given me two snacks in here. So I've got some baked pretzels.
Oh, very nice.
And some roasted chickpeas as well. Sea salt and vinegar. Then in the box, you get your 8 beers as well that are in, you know, beautiful cans, all different designs in them as well. And really, the thing about Beer 52 is it encourages you to try things that maybe you wouldn't normally buy in the supermarket. So they're experts and they're on a mission to find the best beer anywhere on the planet. And each month they visit a different place. So it can be, you know, small batch breweries from around the world, which is another reason that we love them, because they support the little guys, which is important, I think.
Like my dad got a case the other day, and I just dived in there, and we were literally fighting over the beers. I was like, oh, I love this one. And he's like, you're not going to take that one. That one's mine. So, you know, there's a really nice selection, and you can go for like mixed beers as well. So you can have a selection of light or dark, or you can just go for light beers, which are actually vegan friendly as well, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, except I know you're more of a light beer kind of guy.
There was some Pilsner in there, and I was getting mad for it.
So why don't you check them out? Get your free case of beer, and also you will get the snack in there as well. And also you will get their award-winning beer magazine, Ferment, and you get the snacks to wash the beer down too. There's no minimum commitment. You can just take the free case if you want. Try the beers out over the weekend, see what you think. If it's not for you, you can pause or cancel at any time. So claim your free case of beer on us right now. Head to beer52.com/retro, beer52.com/retro, and a big thank you to our amazing friends at Beer 52 for their support of the Retro Hour podcast. Now next weekend it's going to be patrons hangout time again.
I was like, what's coming up next weekend then?
Only the best weekend of the month, Joe.
I did get scared then, but no, it's our lovely Patreons hangout, luckily.
So for someone who may not have joined us on a Patreons hangout before, might be thinking, oh, I hear these guys talking about it. You know, why would you suggest they come and join us then? Why should they spend a Sunday evening with us, Scott?
Well, first of all, they get to hang out with us guys for a couple of hours. You know, what's better than that on a Sunday evening? No, but jokes aside, it is cool. It is cool just to kind of come and have a hangout. The main thing we kind of do is geek out about each of us retro games rooms and what we've bought recently, sometimes spend a little bit of money. But we end up talking a lot just about nostalgic tech as well. Like, we talk about mobile phones. We're talking about laser discs the other week. We end up talking a lot of time about
ninja movies.
Ninja movies, horror films. We just hang out, don't we? Which is really cool. And it really helped over like 2020 and this year as well. People don't have to get involved. Some people just come on and they just listen, you know, sit with the camera off and stuff like that.
It becomes the show and tell as well, doesn't it?
Yeah,
100%. It's like, look, class, this is what I've bought in today. You see people's setups and kind of new stuff that they've bought or want to discuss. We've even had, you know, a golden Games Master joystick on there.
We have, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really fun time.
And I think in terms of, you know, if you want support on things or you want, you know, you've got a question about something, they're a really knowledgeable bunch. I mean, the guys on our Hangouts know way more than we do about retro systems in general. So if I've got any questions or whatever, you know, they're really good. Like, oh, you should buy this add-on for it. And, you know, it's just, it's a bit like a virtual users group.
Yeah, really. Totally.
Yeah.
So we're all going to be getting together again next weekend on Sunday, the 22nd of August at 8 p.m. UK time. All patrons are welcome to join us for it. So if you'd like to come along, give us a little back on Patreon. I mean, you can do it for the cost of a cup of coffee once a month, and you will get the invite link in there as well. Not the only thing you get for being a patron, though. Our gold supporters and above, they can check out exclusive patrons-only podcasts. And we're actually going to be recording the next episode of that in the next week as well. This is the Retro Hour After Hours, where we kind of do, you know, entire episodes about specific consoles. We talk a bit about our memories. And also we do a thing called the Retro Years, which is an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours on games, tech, consoles from a specific year. And we're going to be focusing on the year 2002. Which last week, actually, after we finished recording, we were like, did much happen in 2002? Then we spent about 20 minutes going through all the things that happened in 2002. There was quite a lot of good games coming out.
There was a lot of good games. There wasn't many consoles.
They're all out by then.
You know, we're kind of in the middle of that generation, but there was certainly some good games and some good films for us to talk about as well. And also, it's always funny talking about where we were in life as well.
I was trying to tell you guys that Coldplay were cool at one point, and you just didn't believe me. I'm going to have to do the convincer on that.
Yeah, Ravi was at Glastonbury watching Coldplay. You should admit that, Ravi.
Oh, it was great. I was with 270,000 people, so they were all fools.
You weren't convincing me, Joe. But, it, you know, it was, apart from Coldplay, a very good year, 2002. So we're going to be talking all about that in the Retro Hour After Hours podcast. If you're a patron, you get the normal show early. You get it ad-free as well. So really, you're backing us on Patreon, though, just to ensure that we can keep bringing this show out for you every single week. All our costs are covered. We don't have to pay for it all. So it really helps us out. And for doing that, you will get a mention in the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, the Retro Hour Hall of Fame. Like this week, a big thank you to Lee Gregory,
Ludwig Signal,
Richard Pickles,
Simon Buckner,
and Peter Savage,
who all made donations into the running of the show. We hugely appreciate that. And if you'd like to do the same, you'll find it all on our website at theretrohour.com. Right then, next, we're going to be joined by the incredible Chris Barnett. who's the host of the awesome Explaining Computers on YouTube, for a bit of a retrospective and a look back. Such a nostalgic chat. Chris is next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for our favourite part of the show, where we welcome on a very special guest. And today, we're going to be talking to someone who's done so much in the world of computers over the last couple of decades. He's an author, he was a computer science teacher as well, a futurologist, and of course, the host of one of our favourite YouTube channels, the fabulous Explaining Computers. Let's welcome to the show, Chris Barnett. Hello, Chris.
Hello, it's great to be on the show.
Fantastic to have you joining us. Now, I did mention then you are a futurologist, so I think it is going to be quite interesting to kind of spin that on its head a little bit and actually talk about the past with you for a change.
Yes, absolutely. I'm spread across so many areas of future stuff, computing stuff, but I've always, well, I've been into computers for a great many decades, as you said, so there's a lot of stuff we can go back to.
Well, what interested you when you were a kid then? Were you like this, you know, the kid that took apart the video recorder or the hi-fi to see how it worked and put it back together? And what kind of got you into electronics? Were you like inquisitive in that regard?
Yes, I think very much. I mean, the video recorder wasn't around then, sadly, but right. I took a lot of radios apart and that type of thing, and took out components and built little oscillators and that type of stuff. And in fact, I once remember my father gave me a calculator that stopped working. And these were days when calculators were quite, you know, big and expensive things. He had it for work. And I managed to take it apart and mend it. And he took it back again at that point, which was hardly surprising. So it's I always found it interesting to see what was going on inside devices. And I guess that followed through into my interest in technology today.
Did you have like a little electronics kit at all, or any of these kind of educational kits that were built?
I do remember having one of the, I think it was the Tandy kits, which have a little springs for the connectors to the various parts of it. So
it's like 50 in one.
That's right. That's exactly it. Yes. Yeah. And they had a sort of little wooden surround to the edge of them, and you could wire up a transistor and a photocell and things like that. I started with one of those, but then I moved on to say to bit some old radios or other any old electronics I could find, and you know, we'd take the transistors out, the resistors out, and whatever, and build bits like that. And I also remember getting components from the Tandy stores. You know, we'd go in and buy, you know, a couple of LEDs or something, which was really exciting at the time to build something that made an LED flash, which probably wouldn't impress people today, but at the time it was really, you felt you were into something really modern.
So what was your earliest computer memory then?
I think my very earliest was a book called, I think, something like The Ladybird Book of Computing, which I had when I was very young. I must have been sort of 5 or 6. And this was all about things like core storage and that type of stuff. And I don't know why that stuck and really sort of resonated with me, but it did. So there was this Ladybird book that had, you know, pictures of people looking at computers and say what these things were. And then the first time I actually saw a computer actually running in front of me, as it were, was at school. I think it was a Commodore PET, and the teacher had just got this, and they were very interested in it, far more interested than those of us watching him. And he was showing how he could put in the sides of a triangle and it would draw it and work out the area. We were going, well, we can do it faster than this machine takes to work it out, you know. But so that was the first time I saw one running. But that the ones that really stuck with me were, I think, the Tandy TRS-80s, which there was one in our local library. And you could go and have a look at that, and you know, you didn't really know what to do with it because you could book it for 4 or 5 minutes or something, which you couldn't do much in that time. But they also, of course, sat in the Tandy stores in the windows as these wonderful devices. So those are the machines that got me aware of computers that could be part of our world as opposed to on the pages of a book somewhere. And then the first computer that really I got into computing with was, like many people, was a ZX81. Back in 1981, my parents got me a ZX81, and that really kicked off the whole thing for me, you know, writing programs first in BASIC and in machine code, and everything followed from there.
What kind of things were you doing on the ZX81, and how were you learning to program that machine?
I suppose there was a very good manual with it, because those were back in the days when if you bought a computer, you were expected to program it because there wasn't that much software around. So it had a very good guide to the BASIC system. And I got into machine code from various bits of articles here and there, and eventually got the Rodney Zacks book on programming the Z80, and taught myself to program in assembler, effectively. I used to poke values into the particular locations in memory on ZX81. You had the peek and poke commands, one to push a value to a memory location, one to get it back again. And so you could write bits of BASIC that allowed you to put in machine code. And I slowly learned how to use the registers and to write, first of all, games. I remember writing Pac-Man or a version of sort of Pac-Man on the ZX81 in machine code. I later wrote a word processor for the ZX Spectrum. That was the first word processor I used, is what I wrote. I remember having great fun figuring out first principles of word wrapping and this type of thing. So it was, I suppose, driven by a desire to be able to do particular things with graphics or with working with words and slowly working it out. I think the young mind is always open to things, isn't it? The great thing about being young, you just assume something must be possible and you just pursue it until you can do it.
And having the patience to actually do it on that keyboard on the ZX81 as well.
Oh, yes, indeed, yes. And often do it multiple times, of course, because you could only save by saving onto cassette tape, and it sometimes didn't work. And you had no real way of knowing if it wasn't going to work until you turned the thing off and had a go and gone, oh, dear. So a lot of it had to be written down on paper. You know, I used to write all my assembler on paper, first of all in instructions and in the actual code, and then put it into the machine, and frequently did it multiple times. And to edit and to put in the machine code on the ZX81, you had to enter the right values from the keyboard as characters. So you sometimes had to do all sorts of shift combinations to get the right graphics character. It represented a certain value between, you know, 0 and 255. It was a real labor of love.
How important do you think Sinclair was kind of helping kickstart the computer industry in the country, especially like the price point and the accessibility of them?
Oh, I think it was extremely important. I mean, the other machines we had around the Sinclair time or just after, things like the BBC Micro, were far more expensive, as you imply. They were much more machines for schools and for people who could afford, you know, very expensive machines. Whereas the ZX81 was suddenly a machine that a lot of people could afford to own. And it changed, you know, people's perception of computers. There were some people use them to play games and things, but by and large, people got them to learn about a computer. I think a lot of people had a sort of light bulb moment with this is a technology that could really start to take off and change how we do things. I always thought it was a great shame that Sinclair didn't get adopted in schools, you know, that the BBC Micro was heavily backed by the BBC, and you can have great debates about whether that was a good idea in terms of the use of BBC funds to fund a computer competing against another UK company, because the Sinclair QL, which was out around the same time as the BBC Micro, was a much better machine. It was a less robust machine physically, and that's where the BBC Micro really took off. It had a very solid keyboard and a case that was virtually bombproof, so it was safe to put it in schools and it would survive. But the Sinclair hardware, when he moved on to the 68000 and the QL, that was a fantastic machine, way ahead of its time, and it's a shame it didn't get a lot more support.
Yeah, I think those micro drives wouldn't have survived very long in schools.
No, they weren't a technology for that, were they? Although I do remember using eventually a 3.5-inch hard drive on a 3.5-inch floppy disk on a QL. Although, admittedly, the interface that stuck out at the end to make it happen wouldn't have survived long in schools either.
I think you're right, though, because it always seemed like the BBC Micros were the computers in schools, but they weren't affordable for the home user. So I didn't know anyone that actually had one at home. You'd always have like a Commodore or a Sinclair. So there was some disconnect there that you weren't learning the machine at home as well.
Yes, absolutely the case. It was like a sort of two worlds of microcomputing, wasn't it? The sort of the BBC world and the world you could see on the television, because of course whenever you saw a micro on the television on the BBC, it was always a BBC Micro. I remember they even had them built into the console of the TARDIS for a while, because it was, you know, the BBC official machine. And yet people were using all the other ones around. So it was a strange situation.
Well, what's kind of just a brief kind of timeline of your machines after the ZX81 on the Spectrum, up until like maybe the early 90s? What kind of machines did you go through?
I think I went, as I've implied, from ZX81 to Spectrum, and then a QL came in. And after that, my next machine was a Amiga 500, I think, pretty certain.
Nice.
I then had an Atari ST. For various reasons, I sold the Amiga, and I started off a PhD I never finished, and I needed a machine I could more reliably word process on, and that became the Atari. And then I went to an Amiga, I think 500 plus, so I went back pretty quickly when I could afford to do that. And then after that, there was an Amiga 1200. with, and I had a hard drive on the A500 plus as well. So I was quite heavily into Amiga for a long while, and then eventually I had to, I recognized I couldn't continue to go with Amiga because obviously the world of Amiga was not progressing at all, the problems they had selling the things, all the different owners. And so I built my first PC in about 96, I think, something like that, with one of the, when you bought a case and the motherboard came together, and I added the processor and the RAM and everything else. And then, therefore, since then, I've been PC-based, but always PC I put together myself-based. But having said that, the other part of my computer ownership has always been portables, or for a long time it's been portables. So I remember having an Atari Portfolio.
Oh, wow.
Which I thought was a brilliant machine, running the Atari, so a very close version to DOS. And I used that for research purposes, for writing notes and things for years and years. You know, it wasn't a brilliant keyboard, but it worked. It stored data on a card, but you had to have a battery in. So it was RAM it was stored in with a battery rather than ROM. So you had to make sure your battery didn't go in your card. Or if it did, you had to have it plugged into the device with the AA cells in to keep it going. So I liked the Atari Portfolio. And then I remember I had Scion 7. Yeah. That was a lovely machine as well for taking notes. And so that also was for me a machine I kept for many years. Right. It's strange. I still have a lot stronger feelings for the older PC than for anything I've got today. You know, today it comes and goes and gets taken apart and put back together. And whereas the older hardware is something I have an emotional attachment to still, because it was things you just couldn't do. You know, the idea of the Atari Portfolio, you could walk around with something in your pocket or a large pocket, which had a reasonable text editor, word processor, and a spreadsheet on it. And it ran on 3AA batteries, you know, which is better than the computers do today. So,
and I remember seeing John Connor hacking an ATM in Terminator 2 with one of those.
Absolutely.
As well,
and they, and well, they also stuck around, you know, those were devices that I think they were sold for about 7 or 8 years, and they were in use much longer than that. Whereas today, models come and go, you know, so quickly, don't they? It's and I think that's one of the other reasons we remember these older machines, because they did have longevity.
Well, we absolutely love Amiga, and one of the kind of functions of Amiga was video editing. Did you have any like background in making videos and stuff when you were younger?
I did, yes. Well, I used to make Super 8 films. I actually was a runner-up on the BBC screencast competition in 1983. So I had actually made films and, you know, start to build up an interest in that. And that's really what I want to do as a career for a long time. So when I got to the Amiga, I was already aware of doing sort of film stuff. And in fact, the first work I did on an Amiga, which was linked to that, is I worked as an animator for the BBC from 88 to 93, freelance, working on the Heartbeat show, doing animations for Tony Hart. And I did some of that work by producing CAD on the Amiga, and then printing it out on a dot matrix printer, and then tracing it onto cell to do various bits of 3D animation, which was, you know, it was cartoon 3D animation, but it was produced from the Amiga. I'll never forget sitting on the editing machine, the Steinbeck in Television Center, with the producer of that show, and he was looking at this one part of the cartoon. He went, "How on earth did you make that rocket, you know, move around in 3D like that?" And it was like, it was done on an Amiga. Like, what, you know? So my first use of computer graphics was actually done via a dot matrix printer and paint and ink onto cell. But I was always aware that the Amiga had enormous potential there. And I did make quite a bit of video work on that. I did various videos about educational things. I remember doing a video on presentation techniques where all the titles were done on an Amiga and against some 3D graphics. So that's why I was so unhappy to leave the Amiga, because I knew it had such potential, but I could also see it wasn't going to continue as it could do in terms of that. And I looked at Mac, and eventually it was like, I'll go PC. I ended up with something called a DC-30 on a PC to do video editing. So I was doing video editing on a PC, I think, in 1997, which was quite early, but sadly not on the Amiga.
I think as well, because the Amiga could output PAL, which really helped, you know, the TV standard.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
And it used a standard signal, and it even had the interlaced, non-interlaced mode as part of the operating system, didn't it? You actually, to use an Amiga, you had to understand video systems, you know, and the system that was coming out of it. And I remember having, it was some sort of Genlock for the Amiga, which allowed you to go out to S-Video and get reasonable quality out of it. And it was, you know, you could mix from a live video signal and the Amiga on this little box that plugged in the back, which was, streets of anything you could do on a PC at the time.
Yeah, and I remember even, you know, the BBC and stuff back then, they were using like, was it like Quantel paint boxes and like really high-end, very expensive machines. And, you know, that you could do similar stuff with your Amiga 500 at home.
I know. Things like Photon paint on the Amiga and obviously Deluxe paint were extraordinary software for their time. Again, you often think about what would have happened if these platforms had actually caught on a bit more, wouldn't you? You know, and we hadn't gone the route of Intel and Apple. There was such potential in these, and it wasn't about the technology. I think it was more about the business and who made the right business decisions to keep them going, as opposed to what was the best particular hardware at the time.
Well, were you much of a gamer as well, or were you really focused on productivity?
I did play games. I was never massively into gamer, but I admit on the Amigas, I did play quite a lot of games. One of the reasons I went from my first Amiga to an ST was at a time I had to start focusing on getting other stuff done. So it was, I knew I wouldn't have as many games on the ST, which I didn't. But on the Amiga, I remember quite a few shoot 'em up games and things on that, which were, you know, I spent a lot of time on. And as I said a bit earlier, I did actually start writing games on the ZX81 and the Spectrum. Some of the first things I published were games on those in the old Sinclair Projects and Sinclair Programs magazines. So I've always had an interest in games. And these days, the only thing that keeps me out of it is that my fingers and arthritis and my eyes don't really wish to get involved with that intensity of use. I have to do enough on computers outside of the games area. But it's what can be done with games these days is clearly amazing. And I still go back to it. I still sometimes play some of the old DOS games because I do like the old DOS games on the via an emulator.
It is funny though, you know, when I revisit games that I used to love as a kid, I'm terrible at them now. I don't know whether it's, like you said, like the body's slowing down or just we don't practice enough anymore. Or...
Yes, it's strange, isn't it, how we... But the thing I find surprising when I look back to games from old times is that they still hold up. I mean, clearly they don't look like today's games do, but the gameplay... It's just as good as it ever was, isn't it? And I think it's a good reminder that it's actually the functionality in the game and how it was put together and the ideas behind it matter just as much as the execution. Whereas I think in some games today, they're so obsessed with the graphics and the story and the money is so big, they lose some of the gameplay in that.
Even like text adventures, you know, I can play them and just get completely lost in it, you know, because your imagination takes
over. Yes, I remember it was... And on the ZX81, it wasn't much text either, was it? You know, and they even had pictures in the ZX81's graphics, which were hardly fantastic. But you went, oh, look at this. You know, there was a scene here. yes, amazing.
Well, obviously, you know, a big thing about computers, especially today, is being online. Do you remember when you first got online and what are kind of some of your earliest memories about being connected?
I do. I mean, I first got online when I was working for the University of Nottingham. And I remember our... IT guy, that fantastic guy called Steve Moore, he came in one day and said, oh, I've got this amazing piece of software called Mosaic, and chuck it on the network, and of course we were off onto the web. And there wasn't much on the web at that point, but you could tell immediately this was going to be something. And fairly soon after that, I got a modem, I think a 1440 modem for the Amiga. So I was first online at home via an Amiga. And I remember I used to have a run a telephone called around multiple rooms to get it to where, you know, it needed to be, you know, every time I plugged it in, because that's the time we didn't even think phones then were for talking on, weren't they? And suddenly they had another use. So I remember that. And I remember sometimes having to download files and you had to do multiple chunks, didn't you? And put them together with a piece of software at the end to download something large, like, say, a screen-sized image. You know, it was an extraordinary place. And one of the things that I was very lucky to get involved with was something called Brainstorms, which was one of the first real sort of virtual communities on the web, run by a guy called Howard Rheingold, who actually came up with the term virtual community back in, I think, 93. And I got involved in that because I wrote a book called Cyber Business in 95, which was all about this thing called cyberspace and people buying things online, which people thought was ridiculous at the time. But because I did that, Howard Rheingold got in touch and said, oh, I'm starting up this new online community on the web for 200 selected people. And I remember spending a lot of time in that. And we worked at how to make things work in terms of online interactions and learned a lot about that type of stuff. And at the time, a lot of companies were trying to build their own virtual communities, and almost all of them failed because they tried to tell people what to talk about and it didn't work. And it became very clear very quickly, the great thing about online and the web and people interacting online was that people did what they wanted to, and the conversations went where people took them. You know, it wasn't a constrained thing. So for a time, I think the many-to-many nature of the web was still trying to be a one-to-many with rules. You know, and even Microsoft fell victim to that, you know, with the old Microsoft what did they call it? Microsoft's old World Online, but they weren't part of the internet for a while, were they? They were separate.
The MSN network.
The MSN network. And they tried to be, you know, we will have our own bit of it. And it's like, you've missed the point, guys. It's the whole thing. And eventually we all learned that lesson that you can't control many-to-many communications. And I think we're still learning to deal with that today.
Well, you spoke fondly of Netscape in your recent retro applications video. And
yes.
I get the impression that you kind of favoured that over Internet Explorer, and quite a lot of us did.
Yes. To a large extent, yes.
Do you kind of think the story of Netscape was a pretty tragic one? And like, are you amazed to see, you know, Mozilla today and what's become of it?
It is sad, isn't it? I think a lot of the early pioneers had very sort of, their goals were altruistic, understand what they were trying to do. And they ran up against Microsoft in particular, who were basically trying to turn this into the business opportunity. And it's almost like what we were talking about with Amiga, right? You know, a few minutes ago, that again, there, the better hardware, the better mentality in some ways didn't win out. So it's good to see that there are still vestiges of Netscape around, you know, in different guises and in other applications. But I do remember being quite sad when Netscape went, because I remember doing all my early web work in terms of writing code and things. It was all done to use with Netscape as a browser. And I think at the time, a lot of us were sort of very anti-Microsoft because they'd had the MSN network and tried to make the network separate, you know, to the rest of the internet. So, yes, I get the impression you're of a similar view.
Yeah, it was a nice browser, and also like the Java support and stuff, you know, it seemed to be kind of destroyed overnight. And when that happened, stuff broke, basically.
Yes.
That's how I felt. It broke for a few years until it all really got fixed. But Netscape was a really solid foundation for me when I used it. Yeah.
I think the fact it also had the ability to write code in it as well at one point in time, which was, you could never imagine Microsoft doing that. Microsoft wouldn't be, here's a web browser to also write your own pages. It was like, you're supposed to look at our pages. That's the whole point of it.
Yeah, and I guess also the paid model for a browser kind of helped its decline. You know, the idea of charging someone for a browser nowadays is
you couldn't imagine
crazy.
It now.
No,
yeah.
Well, even for an operating system, isn't it? I mean, it's interesting. Yeah. We're seeing, you know, that when there's 11 coming along again, it's like no one's talking about we'll have to pay for it unless you're, you know, putting it on a new computer. But in the days we're just talking about, you know, you bought your operating system, your programs, or you wrote them, isn't it? I suppose that's the thing that's changed, isn't it? And I suppose Netscape was part of that world, wasn't it? The world where a lot of the content and the things that people used were created by users and shared by users. And that's what we've lost as computers have got more and more complicated, and that's more and more difficult to do. And I guess the people who 20 years ago or 30 years ago were actually writing software and contributing to computing that way are now the people probably making content these days, as opposed to the code itself. There's obviously some people still doing code and open source and that's great, but there's far more people contributing content that other people access online.
You know, kind of going back to, you know, learning programming, you know, obviously back in the early 80s, I know you've got a background in teaching computing, but back then there was the BBC Literacy Project in the early 80s where, you know, the BBC Micro came out of. Do you remember much about that then? And was that kind of, you know, in your school days still? And what did you think of that as an idea, you know, that the BBC were getting behind and the government essentially, you know, teaching computer literacy to kids?
I remember it going on. I suppose I was sort of late teenager and that was really in. So I was still in school when it was going on, but I was a few years above where it would have been aimed at, if you see what I mean. So, and at the time I was, you know, heavily, I was writing machine code on a TEDx 81. So I wasn't really that interested in what BBC were doing with bits of BASIC. So you know, and I knew a lot of people, at least at school, who were also doing similar stuff. So we looked on at what's this BBC thing going on. I've always been quite critical of what the BBC did because I think they pushed it in the wrong direction. I mean, I taught computing in the university for, 25 years, but more freelance after that as well. And I always tried to teach some first-year groups, the basic stuff, spreadsheets and this type of thing, and noticed over time that computer familiarity increased greatly and computer literacy didn't increase at all. You know, you had people who had these wonderful O-levels and then GCSEs in computing who knew nothing about how to use a spreadsheet and write formulas because the BBC model and then the model in UK schools was very much about teaching, if you like, the wrong stuff. You know, it wasn't focused on the stuff people needed. It was the stuff that came out of some of these projects. So I would rather the BBC had stuck to the letters British Broadcasting Corporation and got on with the broadcasting rather than tried to get into areas that really weren't their, I think, their area at the time.
In the 90s as well, the schools kind of changed their curriculum in IT and it was more focused on like Word, Excel and business kind of stuff. Do you think that affected kids' tech literacy, but also has it changed these days with stuff like the Raspberry Pi? And
I think it did. And the strange thing was that although the school focus was very much on those packages, as you say, they still didn't teach anything in them. I used to have people sitting in front of me in universities who got 3 A's at A-level and said, oh, I know all about computing. Oh, I've done spreadsheets. And you'd show them a formula and they never used formulas. Because what they did in these things in schools was largely how to change the font and make it look pretty and this sort of stuff. And we used to spend a lot of time getting people to unlearn very poor spreadsheet techniques or non-existent spreadsheet techniques. So I think the British system was bizarre because it actually moved on from programming and the essence of computing, which was probably too deep, but to do package stuff, which wasn't taught very well. And actually people had... They knew about a computer. You know, I frequently used to sit with people in computer labs and you go, have you saved that? Yes. Where have you saved it? Huh? Well, I press the save icon. And I said, well, you're sitting on a network here. Do you know what drive you saved it to? Oh, yeah. Have you printed it? Oh, I printed it. Where? Well, I press the print icon. Do you know where you printed it? Which printer did you select? So what people learned in schools was very, very limited and it gave people, I think, false confidence. And I think that was a real problem in the UK for a long time, that people had things on their CV about computer literacy that weren't really computer literacy at all. It was familiarity. I think in recent years, it has improved a bit. As you say, there has been a move away from doing just the package stuff. I'm still not sure to what extent it is useful to teach people about microcontrollers like the BBC Microbit now and in schools. The Raspberry Pi, I think, is a better learning aid because it's more of a traditional computer you can learn things with. I guess it depends how mass market you go, because the more technical you make computing education, the fewer people I think you really engage with it. And the ones you do engage, that's really good and you get some incredible results from it. But I think we still struggle to understand what computer literacy should mean for the majority. And I think that's tricky because we have companies like Microsoft trying to make things simple, you know, and trying to overlay things on all the levels of complexity. So you do just press the button and have no idea what happens behind it. So it's a very difficult challenge keeping up with computer literacy. I often feel that teaching people things like good mathematics is important. You know, if you understand maths, you can do anything with a computer, really, and you understand logic and you think a bit. And I think the other problem we have today is that across education, people are so used to doing everything instantly, they won't sit down and learn about stuff. You know, it's one of the things I fought against in the university in my final years there was the inclusion of Wi-Fi networks that will cover lecture theatres so people could be online in the lecture theatre. And I always thought that was a very bad move to have people being on devices during a lecture, although some of the educationalists thought it was wonderful, because it took people away from actually just focusing on a thing, the lecture, for a period of time.
I think there's this school where all the tech moguls send their children and they're not allowed any kind of Wi-Fi access.
That's right. And I think there is one university now, I think it's Cambridge, I'm not sure, but who actually now have started to put the disruptors into lecture theatres rather than the extra access points, so that once you're in the room, you can't go online, you know, and you have to focus on one thing. And that's not to say that technology is bad, but I think to learn things like programming, you have to be able to focus on something for a considerable period, you know, and some things in life are complicated and computing at any level of complexity is complicated. And you have to be able to be someone who can sit down and say, okay, I'll spend many hours learning about this, learning about the principles of it, rather than wanting an instant result. And that is an interesting thing to look at these days with computing, because so many people are interested in computing, they don't want to put the time in to learn all the complexity of it. You know, it's very interesting.
It's like the driving test. They have to kind of put in how to check your engine and how to change a wheel and stuff like that.
Yes.
Now, because you know, people just want to press go.
That's it. Press the accelerator. There we are. I'm off. And I think it is the weird tension, isn't it? Technology has given us access to so much information, but it's also made people lazy about the way they access information, because you know you can find out something just by, if you forget something, just look it up on Google, don't you? Whereas it used to be, back in the days when we were talking about 81s around and that sort of stuff, you want to know something, and you know, and someone you knew didn't know it, then basically you had to go to a library and find something or look it up. You know, it was work to find something and know something. And therefore we were a bit more precious about knowledge because it was something you had to put time into. Whereas these days you just forget, it doesn't matter because I could just look it up again tomorrow.
And I think you made a really interesting point about distractions as well. I mean, I heard that, you know, George Martin, the writer of Game of Thrones, actually writes all his scripts on a on WordPerfect on an old 386 laptop just because Twitter's not running in the background. And there's not all these constant distractions that, you know, we have today, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I got onto email, I think, in the sort of mid-90s, but I've never had email set to tell me when it arrives. It's always been the first thing I've done on the computer. I will never have notifications coming up. On that basis, because as a writer and as a filmmaker, I need to be able to focus on the job. I check my email all the time, you know, but I decide when to do it rather than the other way around. And I took my video editing offline about 18 months ago now. So the machine I edit all my videos on is not connected to the internet quite deliberately. It's partially because it still runs Windows 7. But it has been a real benefit that, but actually I have time in the day when I'm online and time in the day when I'm not online. You know, and I disappear from that world and can focus on something. And I think as a writer, and I've done lots of books, as you may know, that you couldn't really do that sort of work if you've constantly got things pipping up and saying, hello, I'm a tweet. And it's, you've got to be able to move between the two. And yet the culture today is we should all be connected all the time, constantly interruptible. It's a very strange world. And I think that will be to our detriment eventually.
Yeah, that's why I'm into gardening as well, so I get no pop-ups.
Yes, you can go out and be out there doing that. That's it.
You know, it's funny, my little nephew, he's 8 years old, and I told him that, you know, computers weren't always connected to the internet. He's like, well, what did you do on them?
Yes.
He couldn't get his head around it, yeah.
Yes, it is amazing, isn't it, to think there is a generation now, multiples, who don't recognise computers could have been used as personal devices, isn't it? You know, we have interpersonal computers today, not PCs really, but we used to have personal devices. That was it. You turned it on, it was you and the machine. That was it.
Well, obviously, I mean, a big part of what you do is still teaching people about computers, you know, admittedly more online these days with your very successful YouTube channel. Where did the idea of explaining computers come from?
It came about because I'd done a couple of computing textbooks. And when you do a computing textbook, the big problem is it goes out of date very quickly. So after a couple of years, it's, you know, you have to keep changing it. And so I thought someone must have done an online computing textbook. And I was particularly thinking of my first year course in the university. And so I looked around and I couldn't find one. And I started just typing in random web addresses. And one was Explaining Computers and it didn't exist. So I thought I better register that. And so I registered the explainingcomputers.com and created a website on it, which was basically an online computing textbook. So it's not a blog. It still isn't a blog, so to the extent that it has pages on hardware or software or whatever. And those pages update, or they do when I find the time to do it. And that really kicked off, I think, around 2005, 2006, something like that. And at the time, YouTube was building up, and I'd done a few experiments on YouTube, but nothing yet really worked. And I thought, well, I'll try to do a bit of YouTube stuff to generate some traffic for the website. And I did that, and very quickly, the YouTube channel took off, and the website sort of, it's still there, but it's very much a second fiddle to the website. So it started with this idea to do an online computing textbook and to support it, and then became from that the channel it is today.
So is it you on your own, or do you have like a team around you?
It is just me. It all originates in Google Docs. So I have a Google Doc, which is my video slate, which has all the ideas go in. And at the bottom of that document, it's full of vague ideas. And at the top, there are actual titles and dates of videos that'll get done. And then as a video progresses from an idea, it gets its own Google Doc, its own script. And script doesn't necessarily mean written out what all the words will be, but there are sometimes technical details in there, bits of code in there sometimes. So I get a document together, which is a semi-script and all the detail I need. And then I tend to shoot multiple ends and starts of videos in one sitting because it's easier just to set things up to do that. And then once I've done those, I will go and start shooting the middle of it. So recording either me on a table with bits of hardware or recording from a computer, as I do with looking at software, or sometimes a combination of the two, which makes it even more complicated because I'm normally recording a machine and filming at the same time and having to sync them together. And then once I've gone that, I go across to the editor. And by and large, I will be shooting and editing pretty much simultaneously so that it's very rare I will shoot all of a video and then go and edit it. And that's one of the reasons why I've never really thought about the model of going towards having someone editing, because that implies you're shooting something and handing it over to edit. Whereas I will frequently shoot sections, and as you may know from my videos, they're all done between intertitle sections. So the sections of 2 to 10 minutes in the middle of each chunk. And I will get each chunk working before I move on. Sometimes for practical reasons, because if you're building something, you don't want to keep taking it apart and putting it back together multiple times to make sure you've got the first bit right, as it were. So I will frequently shoot something and go back and reshoot a few words, reshoot a few syllables, often because I get things the wrong way around. So it's a very iterative process between shooting and editing. And then eventually I'll get to a point of cleaning up audio and doing all the final graphics and things. But it is that iterative process. And also the thing I most probably enjoy is the editing. I mean, my background is as an animator, as I've talked about already. And so I'm very much think of film as of video as frames. And that's what I work with on the timeline. There just happen to be lots of them if you're doing live action. So I'm always most comfortable when I've got something on the timeline. And I will normally have the video laid out with the intertitles and the start and the end, the bits of audio, and then just colours for different bits of what will eventually be final shots sitting in there, and then slowly we'll fill it up from going and shooting live action and recording from a video. So it is quite stressful doing it by myself at the moment, because I'm doing a lot of content. You know, I'm doing these days towards a 20-minute video every week, 52 weeks a year. Yeah. I've done it for, 6.5 years now, which is quite a long while to have kept that up.
And as well, I guess you probably have an image in your mind about how you want the video to kind of flow. And we often get people approaching us like, you know, do you want help editing the podcast? You know, we're in my mind, I know how I want it to sound and what needs to go where. And, you know, it's kind of your creation, isn't it? And handing that off to someone else, I'm not comfortable with that.
That is very true. And I think also when you're making stuff that rapidly, it would take me longer to write down what I wanted than it would to actually, you know, pass it on to somebody else and do it myself. I mean, I even do that to myself. I sometimes go, oh, I mustn't forget to do this, 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 and this tomorrow. And I start making notes and I go, hang on, I'll just do it now while it's still in my head, you know. And I think you either have to say you're going to have a bigger undertaking and pass on the creative work to someone else, and then what comes out will not be exactly what you desired, but that's fine. And it isn't anyone a weekly schedule. You know, I used to make animated films where I'd make maybe 6-7 minutes of footage a year. You know, I'm now doing 20 minutes of stuff a week. You have to accept errors creeping and you don't get exactly what you want because the pressure of production is there. But at least you have more of a creative feel to it if you keep control of it. And I think the other thing for me is I don't tend to produce stuff like a lot of YouTubers do. My background is in filmmaking from the 80s. My editing style is very much what would be on television rather than what would be on YouTube. You know, I never jump cut, for example. If I get a take wrong, I do it again. You know, I don't just put a cut in the middle and hope people will be happy with it. And I've often sat in events at YouTube in London at YouTube Space when it was open, where people talk about, oh, there's editing style for YouTube. I think, well, there shouldn't be, actually. But my style is if it wouldn't work on BBC One, I won't put it on YouTube. And I would struggle to communicate that, I think, to a lot of editors today.
And I think that really shows as well, those kind of high production values. And it sets your channel apart, I think, from many others.
Thank you.
Well, you cover a healthy amount of retro on the channel as well. I mean, do you think it's important to cover the past as well as the future?
I do. I think it gives us a grounding for where we are. And I think it's useful to look back to sort of remind us we've come an awful long way very quickly. And actually, what we do with computers today isn't quite as fixed as people think it is. You know, we've gone through a lot of transition before. Computing hasn't necessarily got better over the years. And it gives you that point of reflection. I think also, because a lot of tech YouTubers are quite young. You know, there's a lot of people in their teens and 20s making the sort of stuff I make. And I've often thought, well, what is my advantage? And part of it is doing, hopefully, decent close-up photography. But the other one is I've been in computing a long while. You know, I'm 54, I think it is. So I've been doing this, you know, a lot of years. And the fact I can bring this is going on now, but actually this is what was going on then and how it links to it. And I think that gives a different sort of feel to it. And sometimes I do that by making specific retro videos, but often I'll be referring back to something else in another video and it just gives a bit of context. I'm shooting a video today about Windows 11 and I'm going back to when I bought this copy of Windows 98, you know, and it just gives you a, oh yes, you know, it gives a bit of context to it.
Which operating systems from history do you think were like the most revolutionary?
I guess we would have to give some credit to DOS, whatever we said. I've just been saying about Microsoft, because it clearly did PC DOS, MS DOS, you know, that set a baseline for you know, what the computer industry industry today. I'd also go back to things like Sinclair. I think what they did on the ZX81 with the principle of putting everything on the keystrokes to save memory so that commands were stored as single bytes, that was very clever. And, you know, we don't tend to appreciate some of the innovation that was forced onto people by trying to run relatively high level operating systems with very little storage and very little memory. So, again, we're back to, you know, Sinclair did some extraordinary stuff, and it's a shame that some of those ideas weren't, you know, didn't survive.
Well, you cover retro storage on your channel as well. I love the video you did on zip and jazz drives. Yes. I thought that was really interesting. You know, we forget how easy we've got things today with USB keys and that kind of thing.
Yes, and I think that's, again, one of the reasons that the retro stuff is so important, because we can get so caught up in what we have these days. So we get actually, you know, storing 100 mega data was actually very difficult for a long while. You know, it's the zip drive was extraordinary, wasn't it, when it came out? I remember when it did come out, I was writing a book called Management Strategy Information Technology, exciting title. And the editor was working on the cover. And I said, oh, I bought this thing called the zip drive. It stores 100 meg on a cartridge. And he was like, oh, don't believe that. I said, about £10 a cartridge, can't be true, he says. He said, I just signed off on some SideQuest cartridges for the cover designer for the book to store the, you know, the cover files. And SideQuest cartridges at the time cost several hundred pounds, I think, for a cartridge to store. I think it was 35 meg. I might remember, something like that. And it only took about 18 months for the zip drive to completely obliterate all this old SideQuest technology. It really was a truly revolutionary thing. It came in. And yet people look back at it, they get 100 meg on a cartridge. That's ridiculous. You know, even the jazz drive, a gigabyte, and then in some respects, 2 gigabytes, was amazing, wasn't it? And yet, so these days, USB key, few pounds, few dollars, loads of storage. It's we don't use stuff as efficiently as we could, I think, because of the amount of storage we have available today.
And people don't get the click of death.
Yes,
it wasn't all good.
Yes, so true.
Well, you covered the Apple Newton too, and kind of being a fan of portables. Why did you think it didn't take off?
I think it was probably a little ahead of its time, wasn't it? I think many devices at that time were really pushing software ahead of hardware. I mean, even Windows did that for a while, didn't it? Windows was ahead of what the hardware could support. And I think the Newton was so far ahead in that the user interface was beautifully done, probably better done than some of the graphical systems today. The way that documents used to sort of be scrunched up and thrown in a little trash can and things, but these things worked beautifully. But it was... the hardware just couldn't support the quality of things like handwriting recognition. I remember at the time there was a very influential book called Computers as Theatre by Brenda Laurel, which was all about how computing was really about drama and interaction, and the best computing experiences were most dramatic experiences. And very much the Newton, and indeed Apple more generally at the time, were focused in that, trying to make computing experiences into an experience. We weren't talking about experience at the time, but they would probably make them more emotionally interactive. And the Newton did that brilliantly, but it just didn't have the power to make it happen. And I think, again, it's something that it's a shame we can't go back to that a bit today. If you look to something like Windows 11, then it's all right and it looks quite nice, but it hasn't got that spark of user interactivity you had on some of those early devices. And that says a great deal about the Newton.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, some of the bad press he got at the time. I always remember that infamous Simpsons sketch where someone tries to write "beat up Martin" and it autocorrects it to "eat up Martha" because it doesn't recognise the handwriting on the Newton, which was my experience of using a Newton back then. I mean, it was a great idea, but yeah, I think just the implementation, especially the early revision, you know, it was like 50-50 whether it'd understand what you wrote down on it.
Yes, it just wasn't a reliable enough. It was a great idea, which they were close to getting to market. And I guess the problem was at the time they would have hardware developed and they knew themselves, they must have known themselves that things wouldn't work as well as they should, but they had to launch because ultimately it wasn't like, say, Apple today, which has got all the money in the world to develop things and only release them when they were, you know, absolutely right. They couldn't afford to wait the few years required to get the processors and the memory required to make the device do what it needed to do. So it's like so much of computing, for a long while, computing was dominated by its hardware, what its hardware could do. It's now moved on to software. It's now moving on to AI. And again, we tend to forget that the limitation was there was just no power to make these things happen, even at a higher price.
Obviously, when the mid-90s came around, you know, multimedia was the buzzword then. And I love the fact you covered Encarta in your recent Retro Applications video as well. That was really nostalgic for me watching that. And did you get into CD-ROMs, and what did you kind of think of that era?
I got into them a little bit. I mean, Encarta was the one that I think I always went back to as this is an example of what it could do. I suppose, and I remember wasn't there an Amiga that was based around CD-ROM stuff?
CD-TV.
That's the one. Yes, that was another sadly failed device. I guess the problem was that CD-ROM came along to be used for those purposes just at a time when storage was getting a bit bigger and hard drives were getting a bit bigger, and we had things like the zip drive coming in. And so if we hadn't had other advantages, it would have been very important. But the 600-ish meg chunk of data, which was extraordinary when we first started to get things on CD-ROMs, didn't have as much longevity as being extraordinary. And that probably held back what we could do with that. And of course, also, the internet came along, as we discussed, and people could start to get content by remote connection. And the CD was never going to compete with that, which was a shame.
Early on, it was kind of like, how can we fill this? Just shove anything on there. It's just ram up the CD. Yeah. What was your most exciting era in history of your computing?
Oh, that's a good question. I think to some extent, the most exciting would have to be back to the ZX81 days, because that's when there was so much potential, you know. And I think the distance I went from knowing what a computer was to programming in BASIC to programming in assembler, which was probably about the space of a year, that was a really amazing time for me. But it was at a time when I was a teenager, and you know, if you take an interest in something at that age, you get really deeply involved with it. So that was one. I think the other one would be the sort of mid-90s, when I was getting into PCs and video editing. And I spent a lot of time building video editing PCs in the mid-90s. And that was, again, really extraordinary to be able to actually handle video, to be able to handle sound and video. One of the things I find amazing about many YouTubers today is they will shoot their sound and video separately. They'll either use a separate audio recorder. And I came from a world where working with film, getting sound synced to film and the two put together was a really hard process. You know, one was optical, one was on magnetic tape. And suddenly, with computer-based editing in the mid-90s, all these issues went away. And you could edit a music video perfectly in sync to a track just on your desktop. You know, the fact you could only handle 4-minute files was a minor constraint and you were working at half power resolution, but it worked. And that was such an interesting time because the mix of creative stuff and technical was really strong. You know, to edit video in the mid-90s on a PC at home, you had to be really into hardware.
And code and stuff like that.
That's right.
It was a nightmare.
But also, you know, you couldn't do it with a standard hard drive. You had to build a SCSI array. I got into SCSI drives because I had to find a way of getting drives which are faster than what you could do with an IDE drive at the time to support even very simple DV video rates. So it really forced you to learn about hardware. And I think that for me was something that pushed forward what I did with computing. And then I, at the time, I also got into something called TrueSpace, which was an early 3D graphics program, and that later into Lightwave on the PC. And so all that came together mid-90s for me. You could see where it was going to go. And to some extent, what I do today is just the same as that. It's just the hardware's a bit faster, the editing software's a bit nicer. But functionally, I'm not doing anything different, except resolution-wise, than what I was doing 10 or even 20 years ago.
Well, do you have much of a collection of classic machines?
I've got quite a lot of old PCs. I've still got a QL around. I've got the Amiga 1200 around. I've got quite a lot of old portable devices that I've both used myself and other people have given to me over the years. When people cleared out their offices at work, they often went, I've got this old Windows CE device. And, you know, I go, I'll take that. You know, don't put it in the bin. So there are cupboards and drawers filled with old bits of hardware here and there.
Have you got any more plans to cover retro things on your channel?
Certainly, yes. I mean, I will certainly this year be doing the QL video. I'll be looking at an Amiga 1200 video. I've been looking at doing an Auric Atmos video. I haven't got one at the moment, but I don't know quite why. I was always fascinated by the Auric one. So I'd like to do an Oric video. I'd like to do something around core storage as well. I remember seeing core storage at the National Museum of Computing a few years ago, but I wouldn't mind trying to build some core storage and see if I could actually make it work, link it up, pay USB or something. That would be fascinating.
I love the fact as well that, you know, you're teaching a younger audience about this kind of stuff who probably weren't familiar with it as well. That must be quite satisfying when you know, you get kids and teenagers like, oh, I didn't know about this stuff.
Yes. And when you get that genuine reaction, people, as you say, I literally did not know this even existed. You know, like your point about people who were computers before they were connected to the internet. It's like a, whoa, you know, it's, and also I feel sometimes when I remember when I shot this EDX81 video a couple of years ago, that I felt I'm actually archiving stuff. You know, this older hardware is around. Not everyone on YouTube shoots the best quality, shall we say, they could do and stuff. And I feel sometimes I'm producing shots of things that might be picked up by people scores of years into the future. This is what this was like. Because at the time this stuff was made, no one was shooting HD. We didn't have HD, you know. So I do feel there's a sort of responsibility on us today to keep the older hardware alive, not just in terms of people who make it work, but people who document it and show it, manage to record the video output from it, which can be a real challenge. And, you know, that's something I feel I'm contributing to.
Well, Chris, I know you're a futurologist as well. Just one final question.
Yes.
And this pretty big one. I mean, what do you think retro is going to look like in the future? I mean, we've talked about the fact that we've got, you know, things are more commodity hardware today, you know, rather than unique machines like they used to be. And obviously software is mainly digitally distributed now. Do you think we're going to have like retro in 20 to 30 years and be nostalgic for this era?
That's a fascinating question, isn't it? Because I think what you imply is the retro computing from what the 70s, 80s, 90s in particular, that there isn't a parallel to that in the current world. There will be some games, consoles and things that survive. But clearly, we're not going to have devices people look back to in the same way, I don't think. Things that had such a resonance with people's lives. People will remember more the first time they went on the internet rather than the first computer they used, you know, and that will change the retro scene, as it were. I think the other way around, I've always felt that we will go forward, say, 20 years, and we will have much more sophisticated AI, and eventually AI with some level of awareness. I'm sure we'll get to that. And for the AIs, they will look back and say, well, what are our roots? Where did we evolve from? And they will be more interested in retro than we are as people. Because, you know, this is the, you know, we look back to fossil records to see where we came from. AIs will look back to retro computing to see where they came from. And therefore, I think there will be a much heightened interest in retro all the way through from, you know, Babbage onwards, because it has become part of a whole new type of thinking species, if you like. And in time, that'll link into us. We're getting the deep futures here, but, you know, the fusion of man and machine, I think, is inevitable. And therefore, our own evolution is tied up with our creation of computational devices. And that's, again, means that retro computing is going to become a more and more and more important topic. Today, it's important to some people. I think it'll be more mainstream in 20 years' time than it is today.
And will Doom still run on everything?
Yes, it will, yes.
Well, Chris, it's been absolutely incredible reminiscing with you. I'm sure everyone watches your channel and listens to us already, but of course, Explaining Computers on YouTube, I'll link up your website in our show notes as well. Thank you so much for coming on and reminiscing with us. It's been great.
It's been a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you very much.